Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing in your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. I know, investing can feel intimidating. Often we don't know where to start. And maybe you think you need a lot of money to start investing, or you end up putting it off because it doesn't seem urgent and your life is so busy. So you don't have time to research or manage investments, but saving and investing can be easy with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/beyond or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement may not be representative of all clients. Tier 1 compensation provided. Compensation provides an incentive to positively promote Acorns. View important disclosures at acorns.com/beyond. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. Please consider your objectives, risk tolerance, and Acorns fees before investing. Acorns Advisors, LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are provided to clients of Acorns by Acorns Securities, LLC. Member FINRA/SIPC. For more information, visit acorns.com. Hello and welcome back to Beyond the To-Do List, a podcast about productivity. I'm Eric Fisher, your host, as we discuss the true goal of productivity, living a more meaningful life. This week, I'm excited to share with you a conversation I had with Barry Kudrowitz. He's the author of the book, Sparking Creativity, How Play and Humor Fuel Innovation and Design. And that's what we're talking about, where work meets play and humor. We're going to discover how the lines between work and play can blur, transforming chores and mundane activities into engaging activities. We're talking about how changing your mindset can make chores feel more like play, and he's got some great examples of that. We're also going to talk about how educators and professionals can innovate and make learning spaces and workspaces more engaging so that we're fostering more creativity, but especially participation. We're also going to talk a little bit about Seinfeld's humor and how that can be applied, as well as the game Apples to Apples and the game Taboo, and how that can push the boundaries of conventional thinking. And we're going to get into how we can get into that new perspective of questioning everyday life like a design detective, a la 99% Invisible, one of my favorite podcasts, and how you can uncover humor and innovation, much like Seinfeld's humor, and have that shape the way that you notice things on purpose, causing you to be more creative. So whether you're creative looking to inject more creativity into your workplace or your team's workplace, or you're a teacher that wants to make learning more dynamic, or you're a parent that wants to work with your kids better in that regard, get them to enjoy their chores maybe, or you're looking to increase your own personal creative well, tap into it deeper. This episode is packed with insights for you. So enjoy this conversation with Barry Kudrowitz. Well, this week, I am privileged to welcome to the show, Barry Kudrowitz. Barry, welcome to Beyond the To-Do List.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Very excited to talk with you. I know it's a productivity show and we like to go out from beyond just, I mean, that's the name of the show, Beyond the To-Do List. We're not talking strictly about to-do lists. We're talking about all aspects of productivity. And I love to have that little word productivity in the center, but then have all the spokes off that hub go in any which direction. We've talked about creativity. We've talked about many other things, but that's the one that kind of fits the most, especially with your book, Sparking Creativity, How Play and Humor Fuel Innovation and Design. Great book. And it's like a summary of like, what, 15 to 16 something plus years of all these different experiences you've had with academic work, but also creativity, humor, design, play, how those all mesh. I'm so curious, you know, obviously we need creative problem solving solutions, but, and that would be a great catalyst for, hey, you should write this book. Was it an idea of yours or did somebody else come to you?
No, I've always worked on creativity research in academia. That's my kind of like my focus of what I do. I'm interested in how people perceive creativity, assess creativity, how we teach creativity. And so I just have years of research studies that surround this world. And then simultaneously, I work with the toy industry. I teach toy design. My PhD was on improv comedy. So I've been doing all this stuff related to play and humor for many years now.
I love it. And obviously, if I can describe the book a little bit for somebody who hasn't yet seen it, but should, we've talked to other people about books that are on creativity, et cetera. This is a different take. It's a take that definitely was needed because there's illustrations and many, many pop culture references that are all over the place, which are great. I don't think I found all the Easter eggs, honestly. I think there were some in there that, like, not that you meant for them to be hidden. I think there was just some that were just, oh, that's a subtle nod to something, you know? So,
yeah, it's full of that stuff. Like, I had to make the book entertaining for me to write.
Yes.
And I also want to make it a book that I want to read. And so it's just full of stuff like with superheroes and sci-fi and television and movies and games and stuff. Things that I think are really interesting to analyze and talk about. And then also as a designer, I'm very visual. And so there's like 150, I don't know how many more, like handmade color illustrations throughout the book because I like picture books too. That's how I learn.
Yeah. It's you went ahead and did the thing that nobody else would do, which is create a book about creativity for people who learn in a certain style or manner. Like they don't want to read an, you know, an academic title that's just, here's how to be creative. You know, it's a stuffed shirt kind of book. This is the opposite completely. And I love it.
That essentially is my prospectus pitch to publishers. It was not, like, in a nutshell, you said it right there. So basically there's books on creativity out there that are written by academics. You would have no idea that this person's like is in tune with their creative side, right? There's nothing creative about the book itself. It's just like a deep dive into literature about creativity. And then on the other hand, there'd be books that are written by creative individuals who maybe don't know anything about the literature on creativity. And so this is somewhere in the middle where what I'm talking about is based on research. It's based on academic studies. It's based on my own studies, but it's also a fun, engaging read written by someone who is a creative and makes stuff.
Yeah, you're almost a translator in a way. You're taking the study and the research, and instead of then just reporting on it, the best thing I can almost put it towards is you're almost doing a one-man show of it with props and everything inside the book.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's it. Thank you. You know, I was trying to analyze joke theory in the book in one of the chapters.
Yeah.
And we talk about like what makes something funny and like degree of separation, like how far you have to stretch to make an interesting connection. And I was like, oh, there's a really great example of this in Wayne's World and in like this Spinal Tap. And I was like, okay, I'm going to use those examples to teach joke theory as opposed to like, you know, there might be we'll set up a study with suitcases and somebody picked up the suitcase and it was really heavy and it wasn't, and this suitcase weighed this amount. And I mean, that's fine. That's an interesting way to explain joke theory, but it's not fun and it's not super relatable.
Not at all. I think that obviously one of the things that people get hung up on is when people hear the word creativity, they start to get in their head about it sometimes and they put it together with another word, creative. It becomes a noun in that it's a label. Oh, that person is a creative. Especially these days where you've got people that are being called creators, the creator economy and things like that. And it's funny because we can, you know, a lot of people will think they're not creative because they're not either a creator or not been labeled a creative. And I would say that's a false pretense. That's a false assessment of the whole thing. How do you, I don't want to say it this way, but how do you label someone as creative, or how do you tell someone? I think you put it this way. You talk about like four requisites of a creative person. Let's talk about what a creative person does instead of being labeled a creative.
Yeah. I think in different fields, they tend to be like, that's a creative field. Like, oh, you do design. That's a creative field. Or you're an artist. That's a creative field. Or you're a writer. That's creative. You could be creative in I would say any discipline. You can be a very creative nurse, be a very creative lawyer. I think we blur a lot of things together. So we think maybe that the arts are creative and like the sciences are not creative for some reason. And if you want to be more creative, you take art classes. That's not necessarily true. Those are just different mediums for creating. And then some where we say right brain or left brain, and that's a right brain. I don't fully buy into that. We're using our whole brain in a lot of different activities, but everyone can be more creative. Some research in that I present in the book on this as well. Everyone can learn to be more creative. It's about developing different skill sets, which are teachable.
Well, and that's essentially what I'm getting at here, is that you're talking about how the subtitle of the book, How Play and Humor Fuel Innovation and Design. Innovation and design aren't just for designers. Innovation is creative thinking. It's applied to any and every instance. And, you know, I've heard the example that anybody's creative if they're problem solving. They're coming up with creative solutions. That definition, which has been a kind of working definition for branching out of just labeling it as you're creative or you're not, or you're this or you're that, still is a bit rigid. I would say what you're doing here in this book is encouraging play in any and all aspects. And what I'm getting at here is in some of the ways that you've done it, where you've done it in like classroom settings or working with toys or different things like that. In terms of like taking something that's academic, it's supposed to be learning. Well, then we think we're supposed to memorize something, or we're supposed to talk through or dialogue something. But how creative can you be if you're not enjoying the process, in other words, of making or learning?
Yeah, I think that when we talk about play, it doesn't mean that the thing has to be silly or goofy or for kids. It doesn't have to be sloppy or messy or pretend like I don't have to put on a costume. Play is just a state of mind. And you can be in that playful state of mind in any activity, really. So that activity, whether we're playing chess or we're playing a video game or we're sorting laundry, that activity can be work to some people and it could be play to other people. It depends on what's going on in that person's head during that activity. And there's different factors that contribute to whether you're going to view it as more like play or more like work. But those activities themselves don't have to be kid-like, in a sense, for something to be playful.
If I'm hearing you correctly, I think what you're saying is it's really a matter of perspective. It's not the activity per se. It's the perspective we have on the thing that we're doing and not holding it so precious. We're not saying don't do hard work. I'm thinking, like you mentioned humor. I'm thinking Monty Python, one of my favorites, right? And how it's not that they didn't work hard, but they had a unique perspective that it made it fun, even though it was hard. And sometimes like, oh my gosh, we've been working on this for forever. They all had their writing partners, except I think for one of them, but they bounced off each other. And then when they all got together and then they learned what the others had written, and you know, that's a more air quotes traditional creative endeavor, you know, so, oh, that's something that's meant to be performed. That's creative. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the route I'm trying to get at. It's the perspective you have on it. And by watching them be, again, it's not the greatest example of what you're saying either, where it doesn't have to be silly. They were incredibly silly.
Yeah.
Always. It's kind of what's like so jarring about when you see interviews with the four of the Beatles lined up and they're giving these just answers. Like they're, you know, they're structured and they do their music and whatever. But then when they're being interviewed, they're like, you know, throwing jokes out left and right that are witty. And it's like, they're in the moment. They're having fun. In other words, it's a perspective.
So I give you some examples. They're both kid examples and they're both in the Netherlands. So they have these Kinderboerderij, which are like basically city farms experiences, sort of like playgrounds where kids go to learn about taking care of animals and growing vegetables and stuff. They're all over the Netherlands. And I brought my 2-year-old there when we were living there. You can brush the cows and stuff. And then you go into this little area where you can get a shovel and you get a little tiny wheelbarrow for the little kids to walk around. You go into the pasture and they take their rake and their shovel and their little wheelbarrow and they go around and they pick up poop for hours and they just shovel it. They're picking up the sheep poop and the cow poop. They're putting in their wheelbarrow and they're taking their wheelbarrow and they're dumping it in a pile and they're going back And I'm watching this and I'm like, this is like my kid views this as play. Like an hour they were doing this and then they wanted to come back the next day and pick up poop. And most people would view that as chore, but something about this activity made that play such that my son wanted to keep doing that activity. Well, one thing was it was the right amount of challenge for him. Those motions, it was a new thing. He was learning how to maneuver this wheelbarrow and scoop things and dump things. He was doing it because he wanted to do it. I wasn't making him do it. He had the choice of doing that. And I mean, there was some level of pretense. It didn't matter if he did it or not. He's not going to, you know, get punished if he does it wrong or whatever. So there's elements of here that make that activity play. People outside, they would look at that and say, that's not play. But what was happening in his head was we could view that as play. It's not toys in the way we view toys, air quotes. It's not bright and colorful. It's not like he's laughing and making silly faces during that activity, but it is play.
You didn't tell him to do it. I think that's a clear kind of piece there. It's kind of what I was trying to get at earlier, where there's this almost amount of, we're waiting for permission. I think I would like to go do this thing. And if someone tells me to, then it's not fun. It's not play, right? If someone tells me to do it, yeah, it can't be play. That may not necessarily totally be true, but for your son, it's like, you didn't tell him to do it. It's choice, it's choosing, and it's self-giving permission, I think is a component there, right? And then again, it goes back to perspective. It's like, yeah, most people would say it's a chore. And, you know, it's that line between like what's work and what's not. I don't know. I mean, I mean, he's definitely being air quotes. And we're going to use a lot of air quotes, I guess. Air quotes productive because he was doing a thing that did need to be done. But it wasn't like it was hungry, hungry hippos gamification of it, where it's like, how many poops can you get in the bucket or something, right? It wasn't set up that way. The premise wasn't there like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look in a Montessori classroom, a lot of the stuff they're doing in there looks like work or chores. You know, they're cleaning tables or pouring things, measuring stuff out. But like we know, like from an adult mind, we're like, cleaning tables is chore, not play. But to the kid, they might not have squished out a sponge before and moved bubbles around a table and cleaned dirt off of a counter. So to them, that activity is play in the moment. It also could be viewed as a chore to adults. They are being productive and they're cleaning. So that's great. This is a lot like a different Dutch example at Efteling theme park. All their trash bins are these characters, they're fairy tale characters that eat trash or eat anything. And they said, Papier, here, feed me your trash. And they're connected to a vacuum system. So when you put trash in their mouth, it like sucks it in. It says, and burps or something. And what happens is the children run around the theme park and they clean everything. The place is spotless. They've taken something that is normally a chore, throwing out trash, and they made it something that is play. They made it something that all the kids want to do. So much so that next to the trash bins, they have open baskets for people to put their trash such that the other family's kids can throw it out for them. It's changing your mindset. Again, that won't work for everyone.
No.
Right? But sometimes, like the fun theory, for a long time ago, there was this like campaign where they were getting people to use the stairs by putting piano sounds in them instead of the escalator. Right. And so in some ways it works, right? You can get people to do things maybe that they don't want to do by making them more fun.
I'm just still thinking of the fact that like one family will walk by and they've got extra trash. Oh, here you go. It's almost like, oh, what is it called? I was watching the Stanley Tucci Italy show and he's getting coffee with somebody and they're saying two coffees and then two. And I forget what the phrase was, but it was basically paying for two coffees for somebody else who can't pay for one that comes along. And it's kind of like that, but with trash. But what it makes me think of is just communal interaction in a societal way, in a different culture, in a different country. Man, I'm trying to think of what we have here in America that would work like that. I have no clue. I think we don't think of it that way, unfortunately. I think we think of our bootstraps more than anything else. So, which is kind of where I want to go. I'm very curious. I mean, again, you say the word academic and it's you instantly start thinking, you know, hoity-toity and up, you know, not thinking about having permission or rigidity. And what I see this being is this, again, not to just say, oh, let's just be silly about everything. Let's take nothing serious. No, actually, good work, serious work, great work happens. But it's because you're allowing a free-flowing, and again, it's that word permission. I'm just curious, like, let's start to talk about a little bit, because like, I know that you integrate or help people integrate, and or I'm sure people have taken the book and run with it. Have you heard examples of people that have used the book to make change towards what you're talking about in the book happen in their setting?
I've heard from some professors in other institutes who have used it to change maybe the nature of the projects that they run in their courses, like their capstone projects, and making them more student directed. One thing I talk about in the book a lot is trying to find the play value in the activities itself and not trying to get somebody interested in a topic by disguising it as something else. So like using Jeopardy to teach history, for example, or using a robot competition model to get people excited about robotics. In those cases, you're not going to get excited about history or robotics. You're kind of saying, hey, let's get excited about competition, or let's get excited about this like board game concept. It's sort of divorced from the subject matter that you're actually trying to get them excited about. And so how do you make the activity itself playful and not what I call hide spinach and brownies, right?
Right.
So when you're like, oh, we want to get people to, you know, our kids to eat more spinach, I'm going to secretly put spinach in brownies. And that's how you make crappy brownies. And also how you don't get your children to appreciate spinach. Spinach can be good. This is really, you know, it's about how you prepare it, how you present it. I'm not going to go in a vegetable direction here, but I could. The same thing applies to other activities. How do you make, let's say, in my world, doing research and applying to grants fun, right? As opposed to just rewarding people for applying to a number of grants, because that's how you make something work, by making it about the end result and not the means. Play is about the activity itself. You have to like doing the activity. You can't be doing it just for the reward or the trophy or to say you won. There's this like study with markers where they pay children to play with markers. And then eventually they only play with the markers unless they get paid. And so you can take something that is normally fun or normally play, and you can turn it into work simply by overly rewarding it.
Oh, that's a good point. I was thinking in terms of that whole like hiding spinach inside of the brownies and making crappy brownies. It makes me think of when people start to get into this topic and they talk about play or the, you know, be more creative. We've all been in like a corporate or even in an academic setting where, or a social setting for that matter, where icebreakers are a thing. Like, it's like, all right, go around and you're going to come up with what color best represents you, or what animal is mo-, you know, that's, it's attempting, but it's failing. Actually, give me the answer. Like, why does that fail? I think it's because it's kind of disingenuous.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. There is actually, I'm just going to go with your example here. There is an improv game called Five Things or Seven Things. And it's also used as a icebreaker where you ask somebody to name five things, right? And you say, I want you to name five things that are blue. And then they name five things that are blue and everyone counts or claps or whatever. That in the form of an icebreaker is not very interesting. You're not learning anything about that person. If you made it, okay, I want you to name five places that you would like to go on vacation, or you know, name your five favorite foods. Now we're actually learning something about that person, and you're making it slightly more functional than just a game for the sake of having a game.
Don't you hate getting cornered by family members that feel like you have to hold back some of the story from them? You know, the one that asks when you're getting married or what's going on with that promotion or why haven't you moved out of mom and dad's basement? Then they're not really listening. They're just judging. While you may have to grin and bear it with your family, you shouldn't have to feel that way when it comes to talking to your doctor about that maybe you ate pizza one too many times that week or something else. Enter ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable and actually listen to you. And we're not talking about a few. We're talking about tens of thousands of doctors, all with verified patient reviews so that you can make sure that the vibes are vibing before you ever meet in real life. With ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and a website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. And you can specifically filter for those that take your insurance or are located near you or treat a condition that you're searching for. My doctor recently retired, so I'm using ZocDoc right now to find the best fit for me. And you can too. Go to ZocDoc.com/beyond and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/beyond. ZocDoc.com/beyond. Still searching for a great candidate for your company? Don't search, just match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch that busy work. Instead, use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. I wish I had Indeed when I was in the hiring process in roles in the past, because it is a slow, arduous headache of a process to find the right people. Or, at least it used to be. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to find and hire great talent fast. In fact, in the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/to-do list. Just go to Indeed.com/to-do list right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/to-do list. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. I've been in some scenarios where, like, I've been in a speaking situation where it's a 50-60 room thing and there's a speaker, but he's involving us and we're doing things at the table that are communal, and we may or may not have our comfort zone broken up a little bit, and that's fine. But it's, I think that's kind of it. And it kind of goes back to that permission thing I was picking up on or thinking about earlier. Was being told to do it is one thing, being given permission to do it or being invited into it. Like, hey, let's play a game. And maybe the after thing is, oh, we all got to know each other better at our table. And yes, maybe that was their goal, but they didn't set that up as the goal. It was more, hey, let's have fun. Let's all play a game together at your own tables. And it's a very different perspective shift.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can always be like, hey, kids, go outside and play now. And they might actually want to go and play. And so it's still play. The problem is if they don't want to do it, then I'm forcing them to do it. And then that now is work. I see that with things like icebreakers. People don't, even though they may have fun later, if they don't actually want to do it, it's going to be viewed as work or a chore to them to participate in that activity.
So I know there's some people out there, they're hearing this and they're like, okay, but my zone, my industry, my business, the realm I'm in, it's not necessarily playful. How do we get people to start shifting that perspective from, you know, maybe somebody told them to do something. Maybe somebody, you know, again, how do we get to that? You know, someone's labeling themselves as, well, I'm not playful. So what do I do? What do you say to that person?
Well, I mean, there's a difference between play and playful, right? So that's the first thing, right? So when I think playful, I think like kids' birthday parties and clowns and bright colors and being silly. Play does not require things to be playful. One is a state of mind and one is kind of like an adjective for things all whimsy and silly, right? That's one of the biggest things here that goes against this argument here. People are like, well, I'm a factory worker. I'm not expected to be playful, or I don't want my surgeon to play. And so the thing here to note is that play is a state of mind, and you can make something more like play simply by messing with the challenge that's involved. Adults learn best through play. Children learn best through play. It doesn't mean that the thing we're doing has to be a silly thing or a game. The thing that we can do can be very serious. It can be writing a research report. It could be running a meeting, and we can make it more like play. But it doesn't have to be whimsical. It doesn't have to be silly. One thing that makes something more like play is that the challenge matches the skill set. This is the concept of flow. And when you're in that state of flow, that's a requirement for play. It's a requirement for creativity. It's, you know, a very simple way of making you more in the state of flow is by making sure that the challenge is appropriate for your skill set. If the challenge is too easy, like a routine task that you're doing over and over and over again, you're going to be bored. And there's no way to view that activity as play. And if it's too stressful and that the challenge is so hard, you don't know how you're going to, you don't know what to do first, right? You're going to be anxious. And so how do you scope whatever you're doing to be the right amount of challenge for you? And that could apply to somebody working in a factory. It could be applied to an intern working in an office setting. It doesn't have to be about a playful context.
Yeah. And I think that's a challenge for people is they've either been stuck in a too much or too little when it comes to that challenge. So they don't see it as something that they can, I don't know, dial it one way or the other. How would you suggest they assess that?
I mean, this goes back to giving people, you know, leaders, giving people more control over what they can do and their tasks and their jobs and having more say in the scope of their projects, for example. And so when you do that, you actually accomplish two things. One, you make the person have more say in their activities, what they do first, how they do it. And that is one thing that makes something play. But then also allows them to scope the challenge appropriately, which is another thing that makes something play. There's a parenting philosophy where, you know, if a kid doesn't want to like leave the house, you're like, well, you could put on your shoes first or your jacket first. And now you're like giving them the sense of control. Sometimes they see through that, but it puts some of the control in their hands and they can make a decision. It's a very minimal decision. The end result is still the same. They have to put on their shoes and their jacket, but they had control over which thing they did first.
So it's not about giving maybe the illusion of agency. It's maybe call your attention, whether it's you self-managing yourself or again, somebody else, could be a parent, could be a coworker, could be somebody higher or lower than you, but it's about approaching choice. It's giving choice where maybe, again, maybe there isn't a lot of choice, but there's at least a little bit. And if we can give some of that over to them, it's like saying, which nights do you think this is going to sound so bad because we're working with this with my son in terms of, you know, which nights do you think are the best nights for you to do this chore versus that one? Like Friday night, you've had a long week. Which one's the easiest one? Which one do you want to save for that? So it's just, you know, you can choose. But you can, and you can put them on the calendar for the week the way you want to do them. And then we'll go with that. But giving them that choice.
Yeah. There's lots of ways of building on that same philosophy, right? So like if the child doesn't want to go into the classroom, you can say, how are we going to walk into the classroom today? Is it backwards? Are we going to spin around in circles? You know, and so, you know, that is actually more playful play, but that is giving them some sort of creative input into the method in which the activity gets done, even though the end result is they're still going into the classroom. I seem to be talking about children a lot and specifically my morning, getting my kids to get out of the house and get into school.
We share what we know, right? So sharing what we know, let me do that for a minute for me. It's like, sometimes it's like, oh my gosh, here's this task that I do all the time. For example, how can I get out of my own head? What can I go do that's out of the norm that can spark some more creativity, that can get my juices flowing, that we can, you know, get me out of a rut? I think that's one of the things. We get kind of set in our ways and then we fall into the, oh, I'm not creative because I haven't been creative in a very long time, or the level that I am at is just so minimal that it doesn't even translate as something that I can appreciate and or build on. So let's move on here. I think that one of the things that you call up on in the book is you bring up one of my favorite games, Apples to Apples. Can you talk about that a little bit?
A number of board games are very similar to creativity tests. And sometimes they're actually used as a creativity test, like Scattergories. But if you want to tuck apples to apples, you know, essentially you have a bunch of cards of like things, and somebody puts down a descriptive card, an adjective that says, I don't know, scary or something. And then you have to choose one of the cards in your hand that you think the person who put down that adjective card is going to best describe as scary. And sometimes it's real, you know, you're like, oh, Dracula. Or sometimes it's like, you know, a joke play, like bunny rabbits or something. They're like, oh, they're not going to, you know, that's a silly suggestion. And then everyone puts down their vote. And then the person who put down the adjective card looks through them and chooses what they think is best describes that word. It's a lot like Cards Against Humanities.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's that other one. I'm thinking of that other one too, where it's got like the buzzer. Well, that could be many games. There's the buzzer one where it's like you're reading off the card and you can't say the five words that are there when you want everybody, your teammate, to say the right word. That also makes me think of that too.
Taboo?
I think it's taboo. It is taboo. And that's one of those ones where it's like, it gets you thinking, okay, what are some other, I mean, I see what words I can't say to get them to say this one. I had fun in high school doing that at parties where it was like, I would try to come up with like the technical as like, what's an alternative way to say this? It's like maybe something along the lines of, since I see a can of soda or pop, wherever you're listening to this, call it what you want. But that's kind of the point, right? You pick it up and it's like, so let's say one of the words on the card is not the word carbonated. So I automatically like, okay, carbonated container of liquid. And liquid might be one of the ones. So a carbonated container of drinking fluid thing. Like, and yeah. I was just, at the time, I haven't played in a long time, but that, it makes me think of that. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, essentially what you're doing there is you're trying to convey a concept to somebody and you can't use these words. And so you're like, what else can I say? And it's forcing you to go outside of what you normally think of to come up with a creative way of describing something, you know, not using the normal ways of describing it. And when you do that, well, you are forcing yourself out of the normal pattern of things. You're also going into this like novelty zone of things that you don't normally say or use to describe something. And it forces you to think beyond your, if this was a mind map, like outside of the first layer of things to go to this next layer. And creative people are really good at doing that. They're thinking outside of that first degree of connections and thinking of less obvious connections that few people think of.
And it just occurred to me that the whole, I'm relaying a concept with words different than it's normally used to convey it. You could take that to actual work, or in somebody else's mind, they would say actual work. Like when it comes to writing something or SEO, search engine optimization, it's like, oh, coming up with some of those other descriptors gets me out of my head of how I would describe it, gets me into the mindset of how would they describe it? Or here are the keyword stuffed words that are here on the card in Taboo that everybody calls it. But what are some of the other ways we can relate it to people? And again, even concept and just different avenues, activities, approaches to a concept, it starts to just get you out of the box thinking wise.
Yeah. So one of the studies that I ran was looking at when good ideas come about. And this was done with the alternative uses test, where you ask people to come up with alternative uses for an object. And we looked at the first thing that everyone wrote down and the second thing. And it wasn't until around like 9, 10 things where you start to come up with stuff that very few people think of. And that's where creativity lies. That's where novelty lies, right? And so when you think about these games where you're like, okay, I want you to describe tin can to somebody, but you can't use any of these words, you're basically saying, hey, I want you to come up with a creative way of communicating this concept, but you can't use these common things that everyone thinks of. You have to come up with something that's novel. And it forces you to go into that novel tale or that weird, obscure words that you don't normally use to come up with a description for somebody else to convey that concept.
One of the other things that I see as slightly related to this is, and it's on my brain right now because it's everywhere. At the time of this recording, he's out promoting a new movie, Seinfeld. Now, obviously, you're talking about Seinfeld in terms of his comedy and especially his TV show. And I think it relates a little bit here because it was the mundane, everyday, day-to-day observations. But then it was a show about nothing, and yet the nothing was so relatable. It's still one of my favorites, and I was thinking about maybe starting to rewatch it. You talk about Seinfeld in the book about his comedy and his humor. How does that apply to this process?
Well, Seinfeld is sort of like a design detective. He looks at everyday life and questions why we do things the way we do them. That is what designers do. That is some form of like design ethnography, where we're like, why do we plug all these things into our laptops? Why do chairs look the way they look? Why is the lock on the window that way, right? And he uncovers these things that we do every day and we never question. Why are highway lanes that size, right? Why is there a dotted line? Why do bathroom stalls not go, the walls not go all the way down to the floor? And there's humor in questioning. That's also in stand-up in general. We question everything. We question sometimes words, language. We make fun of words themselves. We make fun of things that people do every day. And we shed light on it. You know, in the book, I kind of do a bunch of examples from the show where he kind of calls out everyday activities and questions why that's the case. And then I kind of show how like society has all then kind of like ended up creating solutions to those weird things that he pointed out in the show.
I think you've just identified why I've been a fan of the 99% Invisible Roman Mars show for so long. I have laughed at the show, that podcast, but I haven't thought of it as funny per se, but it is that dissection of design in the everyday, just design in real life. And, you know, the history of it and the, you know, because everything was designed for a reason at some point, even if we've moved so far beyond it to just accept it as tradition.
It's interesting. I'm going to tie both of those things together. You're talking about how Seinfeld is like a show about nothing and the 99% Invisible show. There's a saying in design that if you do design really well, no one will notice it. I don't know. There's probably some people who disagree about that, right? But generally, like really good design, like you just go about your day, you know, you get on the subway and you don't think about how that was a smooth transition getting onto the subway. But you know when it doesn't go well and you get hit by a door or you trip, you know, or you can't get in. And you say, this is such bad design. But oftentimes good design gets overlooked because it just makes your life go smoothly to the point that you don't think about it at all. We think about things often during routine stuff when there's issues, like when you go to the public bathroom and like you can see the person next to you in the stall and you say, this is really weird, right? And that's when it comes up and you're like, there's bad design here.
Yeah, we notice, I will be first to admit, I notice lots of poor design when it comes to many things, especially when it comes to dropping off or to go back to kids, dropping off or picking up kids in a school parking lot and how they've arranged certain things and how it's taking forever for everybody to get dropped off or picked up because there's no reason it takes this long. Anyway, I digress. So when it comes to Seinfeld and his like, essentially his noticing of design, how does that play into play?
In some ways, questioning the status quo and looking at, you know, a Pop-Tart or, you know, a bathroom stall and questioning the existence of this thing or the why it's done that way requires some playful thinking. We're messing with a concept. We're playing with an idea in our head. I don't know necessarily. I think this is actually probably closer tied to humor than it is to play.
Yes,
because
true.
When we start, when we're dissecting everyday things, we're uncovering humorous things or non-obvious connections about them. And so I would say it's probably more humorous than playful.
Yeah, definitely. So kind of on a closing note here, I think identifying that as humor and knowing that some people's sense of humor is different than others, how can we still incorporate, I mean, is it more on an individual basis, or do we kind of have to have a feel for that when it comes to humor and using that to fuel collective innovation and design? Or is that better left to like, okay, I'll have humor, I'll do my thing, And then when I sense someone else has is a kindred spirit humor wise, I'll align with them. What's your perspective on that?
So there's many theories of humor, and a lot of the things we laugh at are not even funny. It's like social lubricant. But when it comes to creativity and innovation and design, the most interesting overlap between humor and creativity is these non-obvious connections. When you make a non-obvious connection between seemingly unrelated things, that often results in an aha moment or a moment of, you know, a eureka. It also happens to result in humor and laughter when you make non-obvious connections. And so you don't have to be a funny person to make non-obvious connections, to uncover the humor in things or to have aha moments. But I think people who are really good at being funny are really good at finding non-obvious connections and uncovering those non-obvious connections. And that makes them both creative and funny at the same time.
Well said. Well, I really hope that people are taking away that there's way more permission being given and or to be had that they already have to give themselves when it comes to play and humor, being able to unlock better, deeper, more fun work, more creative work than they're doing. I'd love to point people to where they can find you, follow you, grab the book, dive deeper into all of this, because honestly, it's a dense and fun book. I would say it's not a normal book, and that's a good thing. I love that it's not. So where can people find more about you, Barry, and all the stuff I just mentioned?
Yeah, sure. So currently I'm at the University of Minnesota, physically, but you can find digital things about me at wonderberry.com, and the book is available at Routledge, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
Awesome. Barry, it's been great talking with you. Consider me a fan. Consider me inspired. Consider me, you know, just having a fun conversation with you. But all in all, like, I tell you, like, this is the kind of thing that I want to inject and insert, not just into the work that I do, but also the work that I do with others. And this book is a great catalyst for it. And I think others are going to find it that way as well. So thank you so much for sharing your insight and your expertise and your time.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me on this show.
Well, that's another podcast crossed off your listening to-do list. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Barry as I did. And the book, I gotta say, it definitely is one of the most unique books on creativity that are out there. If somebody were to ask me, what are your top 3 to 5 creativity books, I would put this in the top 5 for sure. I can think of a couple others, like Daily Creative by Todd Henry, and Joey Caffone's book on creativity that was recent. And in fact, that reminds me, I have put together a Spotify playlist of episodes specifically on the topic of creativity, which you will find in the show notes. Great episodes to revisit. It's a masterclass in creativity in some ways, so I highly encourage you to go check that out. If you found this episode helpful and encouraging and got the creative juices flowing, think of a creative way to send over this episode to someone you know needs to hear it. Share it with your team, share it on social media, hit that share button in your podcast player app of choice where you're listening right now, and or head on over to the show notes at beyondthetodolist.com where you can share it from there. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next episode. Hey, thanks for listening to the end. If you're looking for a show to start helping you apply these productivity lessons on your business, check out Millionaire University. It's real lessons from real entrepreneurs teaching you what you need to know to improve your business or start one if you've been putting it off. It covers all aspects of business from starting, marketing, growing, managing, and everything in between, wearing all the hats. And as an added bonus, I am conducting a number of those conversations, those interviews. So you'll fit right in. Again, that's Millionaire University. Just search for it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this podcast.